Good evening, everybody. It's my pleasure to chair this event about a passionate affair in which I'm also a bit involved, being German. That's why my role is here, to play the Rottweiler, watching over the rules and the timing. My name is Walter Czerkle. I'm a political economist at the European Institute. And we celebrate the launch of this book, as you know, and that you will later be able to buy at a discount for £25 outside. I'm sure the authors would be happy to sign it. And we have them here, and they managed to do something which I think academics are normally hard-pressed to do, that three people write a book together that is written like in one, you know, like written by one person. And that's quite remarkable, given how different in the stage of their career and in their personalities they are. So we have, to my immediate left, Kira Gasu Kanayi, your last name always, Katsuyani, who is a PhD student with us, I'm proud to say. Then we have Claudia Sternberg there, who is a senior research fellow at UCL, the European Institute there. And then finally, Kalypso Nikolaides, who is a professor of politics at Oxford University. And they all three have been at Oxford, so that's where the book came to be born and devised. As commentators we have tonight, I know this is a kind of funny thing, that there are two Englishmen who will report, or we will comment on this, although one of them, Kevin Featherstone, the head of the European Institute, is a kind of honorary Greek, really, because he's the head of the Hellenic Observatory. And then to my immediate right is Jonathan White, who is a professor of politics at the European Institute. And they will tell us, calm down, dear, and, you know, don't get so worked up in your relationship. The format of the evening will be that Claudia and Kira give an introduction, a summary of the whole thing in about 15 minutes. Then we have our two comments, 10 minutes each. And then Kalypso will briefly respond to this, and then we are open up to Q&A. I would like to welcome our panel for this evening. So Kira and Claudia, if you would like to start.
It's my task tonight to tell you what the book is about. And just before that, I would like to thank my lovely co-authors. It's been a wonderful journey with you to write this book, and a real privilege. So the book is about two things. First, it's a story about the Euro crisis and how we as Europeans live together in our European Union. And we approach this through the lens of one of the most explosive and highly charged binational relationships of this crisis, that between Greeks and Germans. And more specifically, we trace the war of images and stories and arguments as it was raging in newspapers and magazines, in cartoons, title pages and covers. And you see some of our finest examples on this slide. What we saw was a really tumultuous affair, full of hurt and offense, of mutual misunderstandings and misrepresentations. But also, as we argue, there were some seeds sown for recovering and for building something that unites us as Greeks and Europeans, as well as Europeans. More specifically, our story is one about how Greeks and Germans imagined each other over the course of the crisis, and how, in the process, they reimagined themselves and their own collectives. And then on a third level, we look at how this transformed the picture of Europe that emerged from this. And the other thing that the book is about is mutual recognition, and also what this crisis did to the European Union that we as Europeans have been building over the past 60 years, which, as you know, is a truly new and unique kind of political animal, that is something in between a loose association of states or an alliance of separate democracies on the one hand, and on the other hand, a federal state writ large, with a supranational people that supersedes old national peoples. What we have in the European Union today is really a third way, a union of European demoi in the plural, a democracy where the European peoples and individual citizens rule together, that is to say they're separate, but still work together. And a constitutive feature of this new political animal, we argue, is the aspiration around which this was built, which is the aspiration to mutual recognition. What is mutual recognition? When we decided to write a book about this, little did we know that it would be, at least for a while, on everyone's lips, with Mrs. May branding it as a secret weapon for achieving both market access and regulatory sovereignty. Beyond the daily politics of Brexit negotiations, mutual recognition has a tradition in scholarship, and it means many things to many scholars. From the principle of regular cooperation in the single market that the Prime Minister took it out of context from, over a diplomatic norm in international relations and really the founding pillar of international law, to a philosophical concept. From these political theories of recognition, we borrow eclectically and quite liberally. These theories go back to the Hegelian notion that it is through social feedback, through being recognized by others, that we recognize ourselves and develop our own identities. So we see ourselves partly in the gaze of others. And to recognize someone, to speak with Paul Ricoeur, the French philosopher, means seeing them in an epistemic sense, that is, identifying them as someone and not someone else, but also it means acknowledging them and granting them respect and human dignity. And this is how mutual recognition can transform an unequal relationship. Now, in the book, we explore how this mutual recognition plays out in the relationships between different peoples. So we do contribute to the kind of growing debate on how the concept can be extended from relations between individuals and groups within a society to international or rather trans and supranational relations. But if our book is grounded in theory, it is really fundamentally an empirical study. It's an empirical analysis of these stories and arguments that we look at. And our aim in this is to shine a light on the Greco-German affair and really the European condition of us living together in Europe today. So mutual recognition, as we see it, is really a state of mind or an ethos. And it, in essence, has to do with difference and how we deal with difference. It involves accepting to live with difference and to interact with one another in all our divergencies, without either trying to make the other side be like ourselves, but also not simply stopping at the fact that we're different and withdrawing into separate spaces. So it's really about engaging with each other. Also, we show in the book, mutual recognition is essentially about living with conflict, for at the same time, as all our aspirations to mutual recognition in this European project, the propensity for denying each other recognition and these denials are the eternal source of social conflict, this propensity remains imprinted in our DNA as Europeans as well as human beings. So really, the tension between promises and denials of mutual recognition is built into the European project. And the Eurozone crisis has cast a merciless light on this tension, seemingly in reversing any progress made so far in this direction. Is there room for hope? We say yes. For what we found is that Greek and German identities, as well as interests, in all their binges of othering and stereotyping, emerged really as fundamentally intertwined and as mutually engaged with each other. In the process, and not least because the crisis forced us to live out these conflicts, we as Greeks and Germans reshaped not only the image of the other, but also of ourselves. And out of this, we argue, there did evolve some kind of common collective, forms of which we found were a Europe of some solidarity or a Europe of fates that are interconnected for good.
Right. Yes. Very good. Thank you, Claudia. Thank you to all of you for being here, and thank you to LSE for hosting us. So my task tonight is to tell you a few more words about the empirical chapters of the book. and hopefully to give you a sense of the themes that we cover in the book, especially when it comes to the empirical chapters. So the hurtful kind of images that you see in the slide that we have, that we are currently displaying, are kind of the starting point of our exploration. And I've been asked here to translate this image that's at the bottom, the Greek cartoon. So that's from the Greek newspaper Avgi, and it features the German finance minister saying quite extreme things. So the title is "The Negotiation Has Begun," and Schäuble is saying, "We insist on making soap from your skin. We are discussing about making fertilizer from your ashes." So quite extreme World War II references. So this kind of imagery, and also associated stereotypical tropes, such as those about the Greeks who swindled their way into the Eurozone, a very typical phrase that we found in German discourses, or that about the Germans who want to impose a Fourth Reich in Athens. These kinds of things were what motivated our study. But fortunately, what we found is that the world is more complicated, and the narratives that we found in our primary sources were far more varied. And one of the aims in the book for us was to actually reflect this variety. So what we have done in the empirical chapters of the book was to interweave the different narratives that we found in our Greek and German materials around a number of thematic patterns, and to point out the commonalities and the differences between the Greek and German discursive strands, as well as commenting on the context in which those different narratives had a resonance. All right, so in this context, the first kind of empirical chapter that we have, which is chapter 2 in the book, focuses on Greco-German representations of the other, as well as the feedback effect that those representations had on the self. So we begin this chapter with the theme of Greek squanderers and German misers, where we discuss the stereotypical trope of the spendthrift Greek, but also the widespread sympathy with the suffering of ordinary Greek people that we encountered in the German media, as well as the biting self-criticism of Greeks for their habits during the pre-crisis years. In fact, Greeks came to call these pre-crisis years the age of the lobster pasta, which is a term that connotes a time of reckless spending and effortlessly acquired unsustainable prosperity. Then the next section of the chapter moves on to the moral, sometimes moralizing, and to an extent shared discourses on the rule of law and solidarity. And we then discuss how depictions of the other can sometimes serve as projection screens for our own fears, particularly with reference to the German tabloids phrase, bankruptcy Greeks. Pleite Griechen. It's a terrible accent, but all right. We continue then with a discussion of the role of appeals to history in the Greek and German public debates. And I'd like to say a few more things about this section. So here we start with the story of how the worst war of words that we discovered in our material, in fact, started and was full of references to the other nation's past. This was an episode that occurred between December 2009 and March 2010, and it was in the context of this episode that the Focus cover page that we showed you at the start was actually published with a slandered Venus statue. So in this episode, German journalists often or sometimes evoked Greece's glorious past to say something or to denigrate Greece's present decline, while Greek journalists and politicians, I have to say, alluded to Germany's inglorious past, especially the war, to criticize the country's present policies, for instance, by linking the issue of debt relief to Germany's war reparations. So the politics of memory grounded feelings of entitlement on both sides, but they also sparked moments of renegotiation of the way we see our past. And I have an example on the slide, which is a quote from a Greek newspaper, where the journalist writes, "Suddenly we have all become anti-Nazi, but it is one thing to remember the Nazis when they no longer exist, and it's another to fight them when they are in front of you. It is one thing to remember those who fought the Nazis, and another to forget that it was not the Nazis who later sent those who fought to the execution squad." So the latter phrase is a reference to the Greek Civil War, which complicates the black and white picture of virtuous Greek resistance against foreign oppression. The unfortunate thing that we note is that these more complex or self-critical commentaries don't usually tend to get translated in the other country's press, with the result of what you see at the top of the slide, which is a tendency to think that the other's debate is monopolized by the hurtful imagery, which is not really the case, in fact. In any case, we end this chapter with the topic of power and resistance, directly following from the preceding conversation, and we discuss the Greek imagery of German despots and their Greek collaborators, which was quite pervasive, as well as German soul-searching with regard to Germany's newfound role as the reluctant hegemon of Europe. Overall, what we try to do in this chapter is to reconstruct the kaleidoscope of views about the five thematic patterns that I've just mentioned, where it is often hard to tell whether it's actually a Greek or a German speaking. But unfortunately, this complexity, as I said, is often lost in translation. So then the second and final empirical chapter of the book does is to reflect on how those mutual depictions between Greeks and Germans affect Greeks and Germans' views about the European Union. And this chapter is structured around three themes. The first one has to do with the EU's promise of prosperity. And in that context, we ask, to what extent has this promise actually turned into a threat to prosperity, to both peoples? Among other things, we note in this section that in Germany there was actually quite a lot of discussion about possible alternative future paths for the EU in terms of economic policy specifically. On the other hand, such discussion was actually far more limited in Greece, and one of the reasons for that was that the Greek debate was quite polarized between those who viewed European tutelage as, at least in part, something like an opportunity to adopt much needed structural reforms, and those who wanted to hear absolutely nothing of the memoranda because they viewed them as lying at the root of Greece's economic malaise. In the second section, we focus on discussions about how Europe may have become renationalized during the crisis, paradoxically at the same time as the reasons for sticking together in this community of faith, and I quote, may have multiplied during the crisis. And then finally, we end the chapter by discussing visions of the EU as a locus of competent governance, and particularly, and questioning them as well. And then in the case of Greece, we focus on a particular understanding of the country's membership, not only in the EU, but also specifically in the Eurozone, as an anchor of political and economic modernity. And it is in this context that the cartoon that we're showing in this slide should be interpreted. And in fact, we note that this element of the Greek debate was often overlooked by international commentators analyzing the costs and benefits of a possible Grexit. So overall, we see the interweaving webs of stories about Europe that we tell in these pages, hopefully as seeds for the creation of a pan-European discursive space, as well as for the recovery of the promise of mutual recognition, which, as Claudia eloquently explained, we regard as the pillar of demoikrasy, which is this particular brand of democracy that we think we should, if we don't have it, at least we should aspire to have in the European Union.
Thank you very much. That was a nice, succinct discussion of the book. And now I would like to invite our commentators. Do you have a preference who goes first? Then we do it according to alphabet.
Thank you. Let me take the microphone. First of all, let me say that this was a book which was a pleasure to read. I read it appropriately on the plane last Friday coming back from Berlin, and I strongly recommend it. It's also, of course, a very intelligent mapping of different meanings, images of the other side. And, of course, it's got a great lineup in terms of mix of authors as well. So my difficulty now is to think of something with which I disagree, and that is difficult. But I'm here, so let me try. Essentially, of course, it's a book about conflicting cultures, and essentially it's looking at the collective psyche of the two societies and discussing the different parts. It struck me that much of the narrative is rather like the authors as marriage guidance counselors. It's telling the other side there are really quite legitimate interests and rights that are being offended and contravened. But I guess in this really rather dark account of two lovers who've fallen out, you could hardly have chosen two European nations, not neighbours, with such a soul-searching angst about them when it comes to their European participation. It struck me that this was a kind of two souls of Faust aspects of looking at how both nations view themselves within the European domain. I think Kira has just mentioned about the German self-reflection, and I'm going to try to pronounce it as well, the Vergangenheitsbewältigung, the struggle to overcome the dark past of Germany's history. But we could also counterpose that with Greece's own self-torture about its position in Europe as well, this classical past and the contemporary reality, the glories and the current limitations. So we could hardly have found two more wretched souls to look at in terms of this particular drama. And of course, each side uses the other's angst and soul-searching as a means of attack. We've seen some of the images on our screens. The German point about two Greeces is highly redolent of a long-term modern Greek image. There's a famous book of Western travelers in Greece, Fair Greece, Sad Relic. That is the glories of the Greek past, but the disappointment of looking at contemporary Greece. Now, that said, I've suggested that this is a study of two wronged lovers or whatever. Now, the book is making a claim with which I would have some hesitation. It's talking about Greece and Germany were essentially warring lovers with a mix of repressed esteem and repulsion, quote, envy and recrimination in their attitudes towards the other. I think that might claim too much in the sense, did their anger really hide a mutual attraction? But in any event, of course, it's almost impossible to confirm how far that was. And I guess that opens up a bigger ontological issue here. The book claims not to explain, but to explore. We're exploring the topography of images and meanings of the other side, not to explain. Well, of course, it's not so easy to challenge a kind of psychiatric account of repressed emotions and hidden memories. But to me, the book does actually seek to explain. Perhaps it prefers not to commit in that fashion, but it does seek to explain how both sides have come to see the other. And I think there's a general issue that could be starkly posed. Is it long-term cultural frames or current economic strength that matters the most in terms of creating the images and the meanings? Granted, cultural perspectives have much relevance. For Greece, Merkel and Schäuble were essentially the agents of a Europe that Greece has for a very long time othered. In the Greek context, Europe has been othered throughout modern Greek history. And Schäuble and Merkel were simply the agents of that kind of othering. Europe had created a cleavage of, on the one hand, modernity and aspiration, as opposed to tradition and isolation in Greece, way back to the 19th century, the modern Greek state. Indeed, you could look even back to Aristotle as to how Greeks have othered Europe in this sense. But precisely because Europe was no longer a frame of modernization, Europe was now a harsh, impositional, unjust, unfair agent that was ignorant of Greece's conditions. And this clearly rekindled a deep cultural instinct in the Greek society towards a sense of victimhood. for long throughout modern Greek history, the perfidiousness of great powers had damaged Greece from the very start. Now we have in the crisis, German harshness became an excuse for ignoring Greece's own culpability. As it were, victimhood battled against self-responsibility for ownership of the bailout agenda. And it struck me that there's, in reading the book, something of an irony here. When we think of the Greek system, we think of Greece's debts to German jurisprudence and the German court system, based so much on legal rules and principles of deduction. And we think of the state administration in Greece, which is highly, excessively rules and rule orientated, etc. Yet in response to the debt crisis, Greece was asking Europe, asking Germany, for the kind of pragmatic problem-solving orientation which its own state institutions eschew on a daily basis. So there's something of a kind of duality of thinking there, an irony. But I think this leads to a normative aspect which may be underplayed in the book as well, and that is the status and meaning of the term liberal in both societies. It's obvious, of course, in the German context, the affix of order liberalism governs so much of German thinking about the crisis. Excuse me, but also similarly, in the Greek context, the terms liberal, ordo-liberal, neoliberal have been regularly conflated, used interchangeably, used as the terms of the most severe condemnation. All reforms have been dismissed as being neoliberal or whatever it might be. And of course, this tends to give a stigma to the reform agenda. I should say that there is also a contrast in the German, on the German side. Wolfgang Schäuble came to the LSE about a year ago or 18 months ago and was asked about ordoliberalism as a solution to the euro crisis and what evidence would he need to persuade him that the ordoliberal austerity program was not working. And the response was classic. It was to say that the ordoliberal frame is not a matter of empirical testing. It's not a question of being tested against the evidence. These are enduring rules which have a legitimacy independent of the economic cycle. So in that sense, as it were, this is policy-making by metaphor, as it were, or certainly it's policy-making by some kind of holy devotion to a set of principles which can't be contradicted by evidence. But in the Greek case, liberal, it's in the context in which, of course, in Greek society, there's very little constituency for supporting liberal solutions. So when reforms are attacked as being liberal, neoliberal, ordo-liberal, there's a kind of whiff, smelly whiff about the use of the terminology, a whiff which is rather like the use of the word prophet in Greece as well. There's a kind of negative stigma to these things. And of course, little constituency for Greece wishing to have a liberal state vis-à-vis the rest of society. So many of the social forces wish to have their own rents from the Greek state. So I think on the aspect of liberalism, neoliberalism, ordo-liberalism, there's a kind of political economy here of irreconcilable frames. And that leads us to really consider something perhaps the book doesn't discuss, whether we have irreconcilable frames of reference, and beneath these emotions, whether the Eurozone itself is structured to create iniquities, conflicts, confrontation. In other words, it might have been useful if the book was to consider whether the periphery can ever live with the core in the Eurozone, and whether these feelings stem from underlying economic conditions. And in that sense, it would be to see the feelings, the images, the meanings attached, which are portrayed so well in the book, as being symptoms of an underlying cause, rather than simply saying how these images hurt each other. I could say, of course, images also impact on behaviour. We might mention the fact that it's German firms above all that have been the prime foreign source of bribes in a number of public contracts, whether it's pharmaceuticals, defence, infrastructure projects, etc. So a list of German companies have actually treated Greece according to the image that they themselves despise and reject. A couple of two points, if I may, very briefly. As I say, I think the envy for the other side was rather limited. But also, perhaps, the actual repeated contact during the crisis actually strengthened the mutual animosity. So even if Germany was the imperial power, Germany never made the decisive choice of which prime minister in Athens it actually wanted, which prime minister it could do business with the most, as it were. It never took the decisive step that might have better delivered the rescue strategy. It never empowered domestic politicians in a kind of pro-reform a coalition. And, of course, successive Greek governments misread Berlin. Merkel and Schäuble were a kind of good cop, bad cop combination, but regularly Athens misread the signals from Berlin. And I think it may have some local resonance. Yanis Varoufakis and Alexis Tsipras regularly said, Germany will back down. We will be able to get a better deal. I think there are connotations here of Boris Johnson saying that Brexit will be the easiest deal to negotiate because Germany will concede. So there's clearly a lesson here of the reluctant hegemon causing problems for its neighbours, not only because it's a hegemon, but because of it's reluctant as well. It's not playing the role, not making the decisions. If I could finish perhaps by picking up on the point about mutual recognition. There's a claim that mutual recognition is the solution to what it calls the crisis of the soul in the European body politic. Europe is no single demos, therefore we need demi, we need lots of them. And we need to recognize the legitimate interests of both. And mutual recognition can sustain the deep cooperation that the EU project rests on. Well, of course, again, we can accept that, but how could we argue against such a proposition? We're being lulled towards better behavior, as it were. But it's not easy to determine how far this mutual recognition could sustain a stronger European Union. Should better cultural understanding be the prime focus of our strategy, or does harmony come from shared economic interests? So, few can doubt the importance of narratives, and it's important to map the contours of the images and meanings both sides have of each other. And the book does that superbly. That's exploration. Perhaps volume two might stretch towards more of the explanation, more in terms of trying to explain the derivation of narratives, narratives as power. There's a Gramscian perspective to be had here. There's a political economy perspective about how the core and the periphery can live together, whatever the images we have of each other. So I suppose the cultural mapping is a superb job. The next discussion perhaps should be where these images actually come from and whether the two sides could live in this kind of Eurozone. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the book. I enjoyed it very much. Just as Kevin has said, it's a very enjoyable read. It's a very readable read. I guess I took the core of the argument to be something like this, that we're all familiar with caricatures of lazy Greeks and austere Germans and so on. But to assume that this is the dominant way in which Greeks and Germans see each other would itself be a caricature. In other words, it's a kind of a second-order caricature that we can easily slip into if we're not careful, that we need to perhaps resist the fascination with public discourse at its worst. And I think maybe there's a kind of a democratic message that's in this book, which is quite an interesting one. In an age of populism, or perhaps we might say also in an age of anti-populism, there's a tendency perhaps to project crude thinking onto the masses, and for any individual to position themselves as someone who can look beyond stereotypes. And I think one of the messages of this book and one of its political messages is perhaps that we should acknowledge this capacity to look beyond stereotypes in others, not just in ourselves. Okay, let me also try and develop some critical remarks. I guess one thing that I started thinking about as I read this book, where stereotypes are very much to the fore, is what is exactly the political problem with stereotypes about other nations? What is the very worst thing about stereotypes as these are deployed in public debates? Now, it seems to me there's two views here, and the book follows one, and I'm going to suggest another view. But perhaps the one to start with would be that the very worst thing about stereotypes, the reason that we might recoil from stereotypes, is something to do with their content, their simplifications that distort the world's diversity, lazy Greeks, or again, up one level, the assumption that Germans see Greeks as lazy. These are stereotypes, they're vulgar generalizations. We might say they're problematic because they're untrue, or because they're offensive, or they're divisive to the extent that some people end up believing them or believe that other people believe them. Now, it seems to me that this is broadly the perspective that the book is taking, that stereotypes are problematic, essentially, in the last instance, because of the content and the effects of that content on how people think and I think other people think. And one of the things the book tries to show, I think, is that the inadequacy of stereotypes as perspectives on the other leads to a process of contestation. This is one of the optimistic messages of the book, that bad stereotypes prompt efforts to contest them, to protest against the kind of unfair generalizations and exaggerations they give rise to. That's a quotation from the book. And from this process of contestation can arise greater understanding, mutual recognition, to repeat that concept. Good. But it seems to me that there's another way of thinking about what's the very worst thing about stereotypes, which is not really to do with their content at all, or the risk that people end up believing the content of stereotypes. They slip into a certain kind of lazy thinking. After all, stereotypes are often voiced in jokey, ironic tones, as though the speaker acknowledges that no one takes them seriously. It's just a bit of fun, that no one really believes in stereotypes. Well, if that's the case, then one might feel that perhaps the greatest worry that one can have about stereotypes in politics is that they're distractions. In other words, it's not what they're about, it's not the content, it's the fact that they distract from other things. They fill the airwaves and consume public attention, or at least they might consume public attention. They might marginalize other things more worthy of attention. Critical analysis of the structural causes of problems, for example. And so even if unserious on their own terms, they crowd out things that are serious. Perhaps even the more ridiculous they are, the more distracting they are. So, two views then on stereotypes. One that says what the worst thing about stereotypes, the reason why we worry about them infiltrating public discourse, is because they are crude, vulgar generalizations, and so on, versus a view that says no one takes them seriously as such. The problem is not that they are crude generalizations. The problem is that they distract people from other kinds of things. They fill a space. They displace. I think this distinction matters because if one goes down the second route, if one says that the major problem with stereotypes is that they are distractions, then contesting the content of stereotypes is perhaps not quite the thing. It's not perhaps the most important response that one might give to it. Indeed, contesting stereotypes arguably reproduces the very same problem. It perpetuates a focus on identity, sets people off on a distracting wild goose chase. One of the examples in the book is one that you may be familiar with. Joan Dijsselbloem, "One cannot spend all the money on drinks and women and then ask for help." In other words, let's say a Northern European making some type of stereotypical criticism of Southern Europeans, including Greeks. And of course, it produces a lot of fury. You can't talk about Greeks, Southern Europeans like that, calls for him to resign, and so on. And of course, that's right. How could that not be right? How could one not condemn something of that kind? You can't just let it go by, but at the same time, addressing it focuses attention on the cultural framing. It reproduces the cultural framing. Contesting this type of stereotype ends up in a kind of tit-for-tat exchange of further culturally framed discussions. It sets off a cycle, and I think it's a cycle that's familiar for many contexts of culture in politics, that the effort to criticize the invocation of politics, of culture in politics, often ends up reproducing some of the same problems as that which it criticizes. It would be bad enough, perhaps, if we treat such stereotypical remarks as born of laziness or thoughtlessness. But, of course, any thoughtful politician will be well aware of the potential for cycles of the kind that I'm talking about, and so can act strategically to engineer this effect of culturally framed politics, claim, counterclaim, and, as I suggest, deflecting attention from other kinds of narrative, other types of way in which public discourse might play out. And, of course, journalists, no less than politicians, in the dying mainstream media, and, of course, this is a book which is focused on the mainstream media, these types of framings, one could probably say, are clickbait. In other words, these types of way of framing political problems as problems of the relations between national groups are a way of setting off a lot of clicks, a lot of comments under the margin. We've got the focus picture behind us. I mean, this is a publication which I think is losing a large number of readers over recent years. I think it has a new editorial team in 2009, and this type of image would perhaps be one person's way of arresting a decline of circulation and producing the type of public discourse that is intended to consume people, to provoke a reaction. The book says somewhere, if many journalists or politicians chose to resort to offensive and stereotypical depictions of the other during the crisis, this was not for lack of alternative discursive options. Well, absolutely, but what if such moves are at least in part intended to distract? What if offensiveness and stereotypicality are the effects that at least some speakers are seeking, whether they are politicians, whether they are journalists, or any other number of powerful actors? If that were the case, then contesting stereotypes is arguably playing exactly the game that those who first deployed them want to be played. Now, there's a game metaphor that's going on in the book. The book endorses a metaphor of the game, introduces the players as Greeks versus Germans, and quite often talks about sides, both sides. And generally, I think the authors are quite willing to accept nations as categories of analysis as well as categories of practice. We hear about what Greeks say, what Germans say. We are invited to treat them as the contending figures in a game. And I think it is a game, perhaps, but not perhaps a game articulated in precisely those terms. One could equally well see it as a game that's played on the general public at large, a European public, or at least an aggregate of national publics. It's not a game between sides, but a game which is played on others by who might otherwise have opportunities for more genuinely critical debate. Now, of course, our speakers have already mentioned some of the theoretical reasons why one might want to accept the normative significance of categories to do with a nation state and exactly treat Greeks and Germans as the protagonists of this game. But I think there are some real dangers in treating these categories as those that describe the agents of mutual recognition. German citizens who deploy stereotypes about Greeks are not the spokespersons of a German people. They are powerful agents who may have an agenda of their own. I've just mentioned two possible examples of that in the political field, in the journalistic field. And of course, we need to be always thinking, and I don't say that the authors are not thinking in these terms, but sometimes it slips from view. We always need to be thinking, who gets to articulate a German perspective, and what about all those fellow Germans who may reject this representative claim and say, not in my name? So if we're to get to grips with the power struggles of the euro crisis, I think surely at some point we have to not just nuance our stereotypes, but radically question these territorial categories altogether. It seems to me the most encouraging part of the book, and I'm going to finish on this theme, is exactly the extent to which, in the empirical material that the authors dig up, many speakers aren't interested in characterizing Greeks or Germans, for better or for worse, but focus instead on particular agents, the government of Germany, the billionaire class of Greece, political parties of each, the markets, without assuming that they're somehow aspects of a national whole. In other words, they refuse to see countries as collective unities, but instead treat them as environments within which power relations unfold. The question then becomes not what people's views of Germans are, but whether they can find allies in Germany or not, a country as an arena rather than a country as an actor. And I think this would be something that would be interesting to study much more of and to thematize considerably further. You might say the strategies for denationalizing political discourse, for taking these kind of categories out of the discussion. Probably the turn to ideology. We've heard about neoliberalism and cognates universal categories like democracy, shared adversaries like the markets. There's a nice quotation somewhere where even Bild Zeitung is talking about how politics has been blackmailed by bankers and financial markets once again. So here, even in the least likely place, perhaps, you see exactly a denationalizing of the terms of discussion. And it seems to me that perhaps this is exactly the most positive legacy of the crisis, if one dares to be optimistic in some sense. It's the emergence of political movements that are actually rather less about mutual recognition between peoples, between agents that might call themselves and be called Greeks and Germans, but perhaps exactly an effort to transcend the national frame. Somewhere in the book is the following sentence: many on both sides shared the view that the real power struggle was not Germany versus Greece, but states versus markets. I think this is the more encouraging story in the book. Those who reject the very terms of a Greco-German affair, rather than those who nuance their stereotypes and recognize the diversity that they hide. I'll stop
there. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Calypso, could you very briefly, if you may, because you have a chance later to answer other questions, respond to this thing that the whole narrative or the way you frame the issue in the book is too much psychologizing the issue. Then could you explain with your method that, could you answer that existential question, can the core live with the periphery and vice versa? And then Jonathan's arguments is the stereotype, the way you take these stereotypes seriously, not playing the game of those who use them strategically. If you perhaps could respond to these three questions, if you.
Well, thank you, Walter, and thank you also for introducing our two wonderful discussants, to whom we are very, very grateful for reading the book with such passion as Englishmen, because I think in this place, and we are against any ascription, that's part of the message of the book, you know, but it is so important indeed for us to revisit all of these conflicts and intense debates around Brexit, around the Euro crisis, in terms that can subvert the temptation of ascription of the other. And of course, in Brexit, we see this all the time, this ascription, irony, rejection of what you think I am, and all of that. So we do hope that the book, first of all, you know, is not about a past story, because the Greco-German affair is an ongoing thing, even if the intensity has passed, but also that it speaks to all the crisscrossing bilateral and multi-level relationships in Europe, and indeed maybe more broadly. I do want to say also, Vatra, if you allow me to say that, you know, in this book, I think my first and greatest contribution was to introduce Claudia and Kira, who had the respective German and Greek, you know, language and knowledge, and who did such amazing, really detailed, really work, a journey inside these media and languages and discourses. And it's been fantastic to, you know, ride their wave and be part of this team, which was really many years in the making. So it was a journey for us, and we very much hope to share it. And indeed, so let me just simply very quickly then, yes, address, first of all, the question that Kevin, you ask, well, you know, what's at stake here? Does it really matter? You know, isn't there some really bigger underlying question? You know, and at the end of the day, you know, how do you explain? So, of course, we can't do everything, but part of what we're interested in is indeed to say, well, there are cycles. If you have power relations, if, of course, this whole story is about asymmetric interdependence. The Greeks need the German more than the other, but they're caught up together. And of course, politicians need to legitimate their action. But what we're interested in is how porous the narrative boundaries are. That yes, you need to speak to your own public, but there are all sorts of boomerang effect. Your public looks at how you're perceived on the other side. Your press picks it up. And so you have to negotiate these boundaries. You can't go too far. And of course, it also becomes an internal weapon. So what the other side, so in Greece, you had all of the modernizers who, of course, would use the German press, but with irony. So we can't go on insulting you and then ask for your money. You know, you can see this kind of quote all the time. And so partly, it's the interaction between the underlying and the story. But of course, you need to then, what we are trying to do, and I think you picked it up both of you very well, is that it's not just the caricature of the other. It's you start with the tension we each have of ourselves. We love ourselves, we hate ourselves. All of us do, as individuals. And peoples and groups and countries do that. So then the other is a mirror. And each side has this repressed esteem for the other and a repulsion. And how do you negotiate this? So the Greeks, you know, see, they admire these Germans who can be in control, because we've lost control in Greece all these years. Wow. But then the Germans fear that the Greek story says something about who they are and who are they not, easygoing and charming, etc., or generous enough in the eyes of the other. And how are they going to negotiate this with themselves? So we want to ask, you know, how in the underlying structural stories that are hardcore economic interests and interest in keeping the Eurozone alive and everything we're all very familiar with, the stories and the narratives and the justification bolster or deflate the arguments. So there is you know, a magnifying or explanation, but we're certainly not trying to say we are constructivists, we believe that ideas lead the way. They're a mirror, they're a reflection. And so I want to also bounce off on Jonathan's point then that, and thank you for outlining these different ways in which stereotypes and caricatures evolve, because of course, you know, you could say, many of you haven't read the book yet, we're contesting stereotypes. So it's a bit naive. We all contest. That's why we're students and academics. You know, we don't believe in stereotypes, do you? And indeed, the Greeks are not that lazy. Look at how hard they work until midnight, you know, and the Germans are generous at the end of the day. But we are interested in when the tit-for-tat of stereotypes becomes broken, subversive. So there's a kind of cycles where you see people who indeed are tortured. You know, the Greeks are tortured about a past that is indeed about victimhood and not being able to, you know, define your destiny, and the Germans, we know. So peoples with big ships on their shoulders, and that leads to self-righteousness. But where it breaks is when irony intervenes in the self-righteousness, thanks to language that you can borrow on the other side, and it helps you take this distance. And so, Kevin, you were talking about pragmatism. So I think the Greeks sometimes, yes, they do borrow a kind of ironic pragmatism. And, you know, I love the one of the quotes which talks about that we, the Greeks, were like the joke of the desperate husband who threatens his wife that he's going to castrate himself. So, you know, and that's the self-criticism. They say, this is how the Germans see us, as self-defeating. But they're using that to say something internally. So, indeed, just to echo what you both said, that the subversion is what is interested. Now, why, Kevin, then you and both of you pick up on our frame, the mutual recognition frame, and you say, well, how could you be against mutual, and just to finish on mutual recognition, the point is not so much to be for or against. It's to note, indeed, with Jonathan, that, you know, the EU, you can read the European journey as an attempt to move beyond the denials of mutual recognition that are the history of Europe for centuries, and after World War II, when even at the end of the war, neighbors killed each other. These were all micro instances of denying the other. And Europe is a wonderful attempt, if a failed attempt in many respects, to overcome this, these denials. And the story of why the emphasis is important, because when these days, with all the crisis, we think, well, what should be done? There's always this vertical gaze. If only Brussels could be better. If only the iron cage and the bubble could open up. If there would be participation. And we would do all these things in Brussels. And we are trying to say the gaze, the optimistic gaze or the gaze for hope, is looking at how people look at each other, how subgroups reach out inside the other side and find allies and co-conspirators inside the polity of the other side. It's these horizontal relationships that really matter in Europe. These attempts to understand the angst and the hopes on the other side. It's an emphasis that we want to provide rather than an alternative. And indeed an emphasis, Jonathan, that tries to not reify, you know, the sides in question, but say there are individuals, there are groups, and what can help them in overcoming, you know, the othering of all the others in Europe.
Thank you very much, Calypso. Without further ado, I'm sure you're very impressed with my time management. We take now Q&A. Who has questions, comments? Sure, please. In the front.
Thank you very much for introducing Zala Hadigran. That was obviously behind his contretemps. I think the question that
I have is summarized in saying, well, can the center hold? And it'd be interesting to get the views of the panel on the extent to which the opposing camps in this particular contretemps have been reconciled enough for one to be confident that it won't re-explode, if not in the context of a Greek environment, but maybe of another, you know, similarly distinctive economic disparity from another country.
Thank you. The lady there with the glasses. Just wait for the microphone for a moment, please.
Thank you very much. Obviously, the book takes a very contemporary focus. I was just wondering if you could maybe say a little more about the specific historical nature of the Greco-German relationship, which might have played into these discourses, which you've been analysing.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Oh, sorry. So firstly, the German cultural Philhellenism, which goes back to Winckelmann and the identification with ancient Greece, and then also the political entanglements between Greece and Germany going back to the War of Independence, and how those play into the discourses you've been analysing.
Thank you. Another one? Yes, please, sir.
Thank you very much. Sorry for the English. I'm Greek and German, so I'm looking forward to the book, finding my inner peace. I have three questions. First of all, the point of Kevin that liberalism or liberal means something different in German and in Greek is very important, and I would like to have your views on other terms as well, because having been part of Greco-German relations for the past 5 years, not only liberalism, but also Europe, social policy, political economy, things like markets as well, have different meanings and a different frame for the both parts of the dialogue. The second thing is, what we have seen in both countries is that Greece and Germany have been used in a domestic power struggle for internal aims and not for the aim of mutual recognition. I'd like to link that also with the horizontal relations that were mentioned at the end, because some of the actors in Germany or in Greece as well try to have horizontal alliances with partners on the other side for their internal political struggle. And how do you frame that? And that brings me to the last point, power. It is an imbalanced relationship. So the metaphor of a game with clear rules for both sides or a marriage is a little bit difficult. And for my reading, and I'm a little bit more pessimistic here, didn't the Greco-German affair show us how shallow the mutual recognition in Europe is and how thin the layer of trust between Europeans is when it comes to difficult questions like budget, like money in Germany, or to be a little bit more contemporary, like in the migration issue? So what does that mean for a future crisis in Europe? And just to give you a small impression on that, the echo on the very recent Italian elections in Germany reminded me a lot of comments about Greece in the past. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So let's take them. Kira, would you like to pick one of these questions?
Sure. Thank you very much. I'd like to make two short comments about two of them, if that's okay. So I'd like to make a short comment about the first one. So can the center hold? And that also relates to Kevin's commentary about the constituency for reform in Greece, which is small. And I wanted to comment on this that, okay, so first of all, it's very true that society came at breaking point in Greece during those years. I mean, not only because of the animosity between Greeks and other Europeans, but because of the animosity between within Greece, between groups in Greece, between people who were pro-reform and people who said that, you know, being pro-reform is tantamount to being, you know, pro-German, being a traitor. So I suppose it's hard to say, you know, give a definite answer as to whether there will be a breakdown of relations between the two sides. I think so far we came very close to it, but it didn't happen so far in Greece. But I think, nevertheless, keeping in mind the context that Kevin has given and that we try to allude to in the book, which is about the history of the pro-reform constituency, its minority position within Greece, and also the context of the political system in Greece, which makes reform quite difficult, even if there is an important social push towards reform, just due to the institutional structure. I think those things can help to show us in a much more powerful way what was at stake with the reform programs in Greece, and that this is not something that can be easily understood through mere reference to economic interests and the aims of economic programs, different economic policies. So I think part of the thing we try to do in the book is to try to show the significance of what was at stake during the crisis exactly through a reference to this context, even if it doesn't amount to full causal analysis, but it amounts to an exposition, let's say, and allusion at times. So, and then the second thing I wanted to say touches upon that question about the different meanings of liberalism. And again, what struck me in the excellent comments of Kevin and Jonathan is that they seem to approach the issue from two opposing sides. So Kevin talked about irreconcilable frames and whether ultimately we can reconcile the core with the periphery. And then Jonathan kind of urged us to supersede national categories. And I think, you know, coming to this topic from those two different sides kind of shows a bit what we try to do in the book, which is to say that national categories remain very important reference points in Europe, and that assuming that this is, or trying to say that this will change from one day to the next, is perhaps unrealistic and even undesirable. However, at the same time, what we try to show is that discourses that come from the two countries supersede national boundaries and have many common elements. And so perhaps I would say that historically the word liberal can mean two different things in the two different countries, but I don't think that the discussion stays at those boundaries. I think there are many people in Greece who are perfectly able to converse with many people in Germany and embracing a very similar meaning of liberalism. And for us, this is a bit where the hope for having a common discourse lies, I suppose.
Claudia, would you like to comment on one
yes.
of the questions?
I think I'll start with your point about this being really a power game and a very asymmetrical or imbalanced power game. If you think of football, you could argue that the relationship is asymmetrical and kind of unbalanced as well, with one nation perhaps being a bit better over the long term in football than the other, although you may obviously disagree with that. I think also your point about the veneer of mutual recognition being very, very thin is certainly one that I would endorse on a certain level. And mainly the book really is about denials of recognition and these offenses that we showed in the pictures. But we had these kind of reversals of stereotypes that we describe. And I think in reversing those stereotypes, I think that worked even more importantly at the level of how the collectives in question saw themselves and more than the other. And in that way, it was perhaps not kind of distracting from something important, but creating possibilities for change in the longer term. And that maybe relates to Kevin's point about our narratives being the symptom of a cause. I think they also have some causal effects, or although we wouldn't probably use this language of cause and effect, but they probably created the conditions for change to occur later on, for instance, with the new German government changing tack quite radically when it comes to funding the Eurozone. And I think all these kind of plays on irony and who we are as Germans who may have been perpetrated as Germans who identify with other things, identify with certain classes, made this possible and prepared a new finance minister who says that transfer union is just an ideological battle term that he just refused to use.
The point about history,
yep.
We have all these fascinating quotes, where basically the Germans are saying, you know, we're actually more Greek than you, if you think about ancient Greek. You know, you are betraying our Greece, the one we loved, you know, 100 years ago, that when we discovered ancient Greece. So, you know, how could you do this? And it's almost, you know, an affront to us to misbehave in that way. So that's one bit of it. But at the same time, what you also see and what we also know in this story is that the Germans have to engage into discovering very often the perception of both the war and the civil war in Greece, which is not taught in German schools. And it's something, you know, you talk to my German students, they don't really know. They learn the French, maybe the Polish side, but the southern, what happened in the south, it's just not known in German culture. So having to engage with this, both the long-term and the kind of post-war histories, is one of those, you know, fascinating bit of the story. The point about Italy, you in your question, you alluded to Italy, and of course this is very topical, and this is back to Vatro picking up the question of, that is with us today, can the center live with the periphery? Now, that's what the five-star movement, you know, asks. That's what we need to ask again and again. And of course, you know, there's technical answers to this, but to what the Greek-German story, you know, yes, it's a story about different frames, about liberalism, but it's also a story about whether, who is to blame? Is it the structure of the Euro construct, the design? That's the dominant Greek story. Or is it the characteristics of countries that are just simply not capable of living with this great currency? You're to blame as a country. You have flaws. You can't control your budget, etc. So there's the structural story and the specific blame story. And of course, they're there. What can you do? But what you see is to ask, well, is this Eurozone designed as it is? You know, does it allow the Italian characteristic, the Greek characteristic, to be soluble in it, to live in it, to be countries that deal with their issues by devaluation or in various ways? Can they be the kind of countries they are, the social, economic, cultural countries they are in this Eurozone? This is what this debate, you know, raises. And of course, then you have policy answers to this. Well, you need to adapt domestic institutions, but maybe you need to adapt the Eurozone itself and the design itself. And in this conversation, you know, we're going to see it again with Italy. No question about it. I think we all want to agree on this. And finally, I just want to pick up the point about trust, which Claudia also reacted to, because, you know, we all love to talk about Europe is about trust, and what broke down between Greek and Germany is about trust. But we all know in our lives, and you know, there's no such thing as blind trust. You just accept with no. Trust is about opening the black box of the other, and the more I know about the other, the more I can engage. So and if that's the case, then, you know, European politics will have to be about these horizontal connections. That and what we see in the conversation between, or the fight and the conflict, is that, oh, we recognize that workers in Germany might think the same way as, you know, the workers in Greece or investors in each side. There are crisscrossing alliances, and maybe then it's not country against country. And so maybe our own title, indeed, I agree, might be a misnomer. And the hope for Europe is indeed that there might be much more fluid politics in that sense.
Who else? If there's nobody, then I would like to put myself, and you are next, on the list.
Now?
Yeah?
Whenever you wish.
Then go ahead. Yeah.
Okay,
then we do a last round.
Okay, we need a last round, so let me be very quick. I very much appreciated the points raised on this aspect of trust. Before the crisis began, I think in the spring of 2008, in one of the opinion polls conducted by the European Commission, Eurobarometer, they asked a question which has been repeated on a number of occasions, asking voters across Europe what words, what descriptions they would attach to the European Union. What does the European Union mean to you? And it was an open survey question. strikingly, before the crisis, words like trust, solidarity, tolerance received no more than 1 in 8 of the voters sampled. In other words, after whatever it is, 5, 6, 7 decades of building Europe, the point about trust and solidarity and mutual recognition was actually remarkably low pre-crisis. I'm tempted to say that in terms of the analogy of football at the moment, football is a pretty good metaphor for different cultural stereotypes. If we think in terms of the problems of Greek football at the moment, for example, then surely this would confirm every negative image that Germany might have. Can they be, after all of this trauma, does the drama finish with the two lovers reconciled? Is there more recognition than before? Are they converging? I'd have thought on that it depends very much in terms of shifts of policy towards burden sharing in Germany. Perhaps there's another romantic entanglement we should be focusing on, and it's Angela and Macron.
Thank you. I was thinking a little bit about this mutual recognition, why you chose that as the metaphor how integration can happen at the citizens' level. I think this is what you do. I mean, interestingly, Kevin seems to associate all the time with it lovers and disappointed, couples. While in the original, it's of course the master and the servant, right? In Hegel, it's that the servant is in that asymmetric position to have to recognize the master, but by doing it becomes a much more reflexive person and actually becomes the master in real terms. So it's a liberating action. We have this other, and you know, Calypso's work was about mutual recognition, which is a kind of depoliticized way of how we could integrate a single market. In the sense of that, you know, what's legally produced in one country must be recognized as being legally sold in another member state. Both connotations, first of all, the first one you do not fully exploit. The second one is probably exactly the opposite of what you want to say, because it's not about depoliticization, it's about the intense politicization of what I would say conflict. And so I was wondering why you chose this kind of conceptualization, when I would say you could have what is underlying all of this, and stereotypes I think are part of it, is conflict. And you know, Durkheim told us conflict is what integrates us. We know now so much about the Greek pension system in Germany, and the Greeks think back about what has been paid or not paid in the in terms of reparations by Greece, and they have actually a point. There was not enough paid, and there were not a treaty made when unification came in Germany. So it integrates us because we suddenly look very closely at that other side that we oppose. And then in that, the hopeful lookout would be mutual recognition, in that we really recognize that it's not along the lines of nationalities, but along the side of class, actors, whatever. So why this way of framing it in a social science book? I had you as well, Lisa.
Thank you very much for the presentation, the opinions that you have offered so far. What I would like to ask is that if we could have avoided the escalation of the relationships and the intensification of the conflict between nations like Greece and Germany in this example, or other nations, by the European Union evolving into a political union, would this resolve the issue, or would it still persist as it is fundamental in our cultures and the way that we interact with each other? Thank you.
Yes, here in the back. Last, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Nasser Kalaun. The question is about the future of economics. Is there a light at the end of tunnel that in this current model that Greece will jump back after false starts, few false starts in the past, to say everything's been sorted out and we have the third package? I read many economists to say it's a hopeless case. And this model for Greece to jump back is being put, you know, on standby. What do you think? To have the romance to restart it again. Because every people who disagree, they have to put some accounts, you know, again. So what do you think? Does the account, the economics help to restart the romance? Thank you.
A bit hard to answer that question, but, you know, you may try. So, Calypso, can we start with you and go in the opposite direction?
Okay. You know, there are no magic bullets for Europe. And I think part of the debate these days is too easily tries to find a solution. And then we put magic labels on it. Political Europe is one of those magic labels. What does it really mean? Sometimes it means having a foreign policy, you know, asserting ourselves in this Hobbesian world. We are one Europe. That's sometimes what it means, political Europe. And then you can say, well, yeah, nation building. So if you think of Europe as nation building, it's about designating another, the rest of the world, and then unifying against that other. And in that sense, you could say, yeah, maybe in doing that, then we'll forget our little squabbles because we'll have that other, the Muslims or the China or the US or whatever. I personally have always fought against this idea, this way of thinking about building Europe. It would be sad that we would so lack in imagination to reproduce, to be mimetic, just like the nation was built against its neighbor. You know, that's what we would do for Europe. The other way in which, you know, political union is used is to say, you know, we should have real debates in the European Parliament or in the Council. There should be left versus rights, and people should see this, these debates in that way. And of course, this would be, in a way, it would be nice. Europe needs more politics. But that's indeed what happens between countries and inside countries. It's reproduced at all these levels. We have, and indeed if you see that, you can see we already have a political union. If politics is about distributing scarce resources among human beings trying to live together in small spaces, you know, that's what we do. And so, Vatro, that leads me to your question about, you know, mutual recognition. Isn't it always about power and the slave? And yes, politics is always about somebody trying to get an upper hand, and recognition is a theory that is not about equality. It's always about contestation and struggles for recognition. Societies are built through struggles. You deny what I want, who I am, what I'm trying to achieve, and I want to get it. I might be a trade union, I might be an oppressed minority, I might be the new generation that wants to be heard by the elders. Everybody struggles to be recognized by the other. And that's what, you know, the story of Europe is also. I would even go so far as to say, even the technical idea that we recognize each other's laws and regulation, whether it's in the single market or the arrest warrant, that's all technocratic and technical. But underlying this is always some sort of political contestation, huge disagreement about whether I trust your laws, whether they're as good as mine, whether I can accept to live with your laws. These are always political at the end of the day. There's always asymmetric power. And we can look at these struggles for recognition in different places, and that's, we chose to look at one part of the story in that way.
Okay.
I'm intrigued by your question about conflict and whether that would have been a better lens to look at this relationship and kind of how we, relationships in the EU in general. I think that really the book is about conflict, and that these denials of recognitions that we looked at, and they happened not only in words and symbols and narratives, but also in deeds, and the backlash against them and the kind of struggles for recognition that we had in response to these denials are very much kind of in response to that and told us about the conflict to begin with. These denials and in reaction to them, the struggles for recognition and the outcries against them, they're both a source of conflicts but also a way of a mechanism in which this conflict can become integrate. So if conflict integrates, it might be through this grappling with granting recognition, denying it, asking for it, speaking out against that. I think that would be my attempt at an answer to that. The marriage metaphor, I think, at best works if we're thinking about an arranged marriage between very unequal partners that are kind of forced to be there, and just because they have to be in this together, have to engage with each other, and again, kind of through looking and dealing with each other in these ways, manage to somehow come to terms that could be called integration.
Kira, and I give Jonathan also a chance.
Thank you very much. All right, to address the third question briefly. All right, so I don't think we can give a definitive answer if this or the other model can work. We're not economists. What we can say is what kind of economic recipes people have put their name under, let's say. And I think what we can say is that in Greece and in Germany, many people have invested a huge amount of resources in making European integration work with the two countries inside the Eurozone. And I guess what we're trying to show is the kinds of stakes that the crisis generates in that regard. But I'm afraid I cannot give a definitive answer. But I would like to also close with perhaps a last comment on political union, because perhaps it may have become evident from the discussion that this is an academic exploration, but it's also a political essay. So we are very involved in the issue of making European democracy work, and ultimately one of the aims of the book is to perhaps make a contribution to that regard. And I'd like to say that what attracted me to Calypso's work a few years ago was this idea, which is my reading of her work, that before proceeding with radical integration towards, I don't know, whatever political union means, usually it means a radical leap forward in terms of ceding sovereignty. Well, before doing that, you need to think about building a European public opinion by promoting those kinds of horizontal links between the countries. And I think if there are policy implications coming out of this discussion, this is, first of all, in finding ways to promote those horizontal links, and second of all, for politicians and academics alike, to think of the implications of what we say in terms of fostering this kind of mutual trust that is built through horizontal links and is not blind, but is based on knowledge of what is happening on the other side.
John, last.
Thanks. Just a word on conflict, perhaps. I mean, it seems to me what always matters with conflict is in what terms does it come to be denominated? And one way of thinking about this image that we have behind us of a statue showing its finger is, I guess, a kind of the culture wars coming to Europe. Conflict as about a clash of cultures, value systems, moralities. And again, although we often think of any such clash in Europe as being to do with the way the EU is structured, coming back to someone's point about an institutional system that ontologizes nations as the units of the game. Another way of perhaps thinking about what's going on here is the arrival of a kind of conflict denominated in cultural terms in Europe. We often associate it with the US, but here it is suddenly in Europe. Perhaps we also see it in Brexit. I mean, this kind of making of a division between Remainers and Leavers is, I think, another front in a kind of culture war that is taking place in Europe at the moment. And if one asks, well, why does this happen? Why this type of denomination of conflict in cultural terms? Well, I guess one of the obvious standard lines of reply would be this is something to do with the difficulties in which a market society finds itself, that many people have an interest in making sure that the major conflicts are denominated in cultural terms, that political divides don't take the form of disagreements about the economy. And again, as I say, certain institutional forms can encourage certain kinds of denomination of conflict in one terms or another. So conflict, yes, but a certain kind of conflict. And I think One has to be careful in playing that game and contesting images of cultural stereotypes, because to my mind the proper goal is to exit that language rather than to nuance it.
Okay, you see that this small book raises a lot of very fundamental questions that we should all be interested in as Europeans. I think the European Institute of UCL, the European Institute here at LSE, and Hellenic Observatory for sponsoring this evening, and thank the panel for a wonderful discussion.